It's a lot longer than I thought.
Now, you know, we understand you have to coordinate with a lot of people, so. Has anyone else besides Paul joined? And Glenn?
No, those are the only two.
Okay, have you heard from anybody as to whether they will or won't be on?
I've only had one from David Maher, who says that he won't be able to join. And Jeremy Banks said that he was traveling, but he probably would be on the call.
Okay. I know David Ferris will not be, but he said Marilyn should be.
That's right. And I think Wendy Seltzer said that, or Thomas Risler said that he would be on today's call. They were swapping calls. He asked me for the last MP3 recording so that he could prepare himself.
Okay. All right, we'll give everyone a few minutes, and if not, then Paul and I will have a good conversation on what we think the preliminary statement should look like. So, Glenn, how are the other task forces coming along?
They are, I think we're all at about the same stage. Yesterday, the task force went through the constituency statements and asked everybody to give a brief summary of their main points.
Mm-hmm.
And for task force 3, Ross has put together a skeletal preliminary report, which has been discussed.
Oh, okay.
So
I think we're doing okay. We have a statement. We have a bunch of points that we've discussed that we've kind of all been discussing for a while. And I think we'll, you know, assuming we get more people on the call, we'll get people to talk about the constituency statements, and then start. Continue where we left off.
Yes.
I'm just right now searching the ICANN website for the bylaws.
I've got it here in front of me, and it says Task Force Report. The chair of the task force, working with the staff manager, shall compile the constituency statements, public comment report, and other information or reports as applicable to a single document, preliminary task force report, and distribute that preliminary task force report to the full task force within 40 calendar days after the initiation of the PDP. Well, obviously that's out. The task force shall have a final task force meeting within 5 days after the distribution of the preliminary task force report to deliberate the issues and try and reach a supermajority vote. Within 5 calendar days after the final task force meeting, the chair of the task force and the staff manager shall create the final task force report and post it on the comment site. Each task force report must include a clear statement of any supermajority vote position of the task force on the issue.
Hey, Glenn, excuse me. Are you reading something from the ICANN website?
Yeah.
Can you tell me the link so that I can just read along?
Yes, it goes to ICANN. You go to ICANN website, you look up ICANN Info. Under ICANN Info, you'll find corporate documents. Click on corporate documents and you'll come to a whole lot of bylaws. Click on the last one.
Okay, hold on.
Hey, Glenn. Yes? I just got a note from Thomas saying he's trying to get on, but he's getting a busy signal. And I resent him the number. He said, yeah, that's what I'm dialing.
Oh. I wonder if he should try the other code, participant code.
He's saying he's getting a busy signal even before dialing in a code.
Oh, dear. That's Thomas Risler.
Yeah.
Let me see. Have you got it, Paul? The bylaws.
Go ahead with the other one first.
That's
more important.
Okay.
I'll work with Paul. So you're at the ICANN Info,
I'm having a bit of want to do my ISP. I think they are filtering certain mail, so I haven't had the mail from Thomas. So, Jeff, if you can perhaps send him the other code, but he can't get in with the number.
Well, he can't even get in with the number. Maybe let's try conferencing him in. Is there a way we can do that?
I can't do that. Can you?
I could. Hold on.
I haven't got.
I could try it.
You could try it.
All right. Yes. Here he's on ICQ. Let me. I don't be able to reach the conference center.
Do we have a phone number for him?
Yeah, I'm just asking him right now.
I'll ask him.
His number is, Paul, +49 228.
Hang on 1 second. Okay, go ahead.
It's +49 228 732 469.
Oh, I guess I would dial 011, right?
You dialed 011 before that, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have to put you on the... You're going to have to listen to music for a second. Is that all right?
That's okay.
Okay, hold on. Hopefully I won't lose you.
That's good music.
All right, let me try again.
Thank you for holding. A representative will be with you shortly.
Everyone?
Here. Sorry for the fuzz.
Hey, Glenn, do you think it's your phone that's causing that echo again?
Is it my phone? Just let me mute and see what happens, all right?
Okay. Hello?
Hello?
We still have an echo.
I could try to mute mine.
Yeah, but then Thomas can't talk, I don't think.
We'll try it.
Hello? Oh, it could be mine, I guess.
You're right, Thomas can't talk.
I can't talk either, so...
All right, well, I guess we're going to have to deal with the echo. Okay, Thomas, it's just you and I and Paul. And, Glenn.
That's a big call.
So we're going to have to continue on with the agenda. We were going to discuss the constituency statements... but since, well, maybe Paul, you can start talk a little bit about yours. I can tell you a little bit about the registry statement, and I think Thomas, I think we already went over the ALAC statement on a previous call. So we can start out with that. Then we need to kind of drill down on the preliminary report, what it will look like. Hello.
Hi, it's Jeremy from IFPI. Apologies for my late arrival.
Hi, Jeremy. Welcome. We only have, on the call, we have Paul Stahar from the Registrars, we have myself from the Registries, we have yourself from IP, and we have Thomas from the ALAC.
Hi, gents.
And we have an awful echo.
Is that my fault? I've only just got to Tel Aviv, so I've actually dialed in, I've actually rung in from Tel Aviv, and was it on there before I joined?
This echo was here before you.
Okay.
All right, so we were just going to go over some of the constituency statements. So, Paul, do you want to kind of go over the registrar, even though we haven't received it yet, what you believe the registrar statement will say?
I could go over it, but it's kind of lengthy. It's also, it's on the registrar list, which everybody can see.
Do you want to just summarize the main points then, if you could?
Yeah, it talks about having two different, highly dependent on what happens with Task Force 2, and it assumes, I think, that there's going to be two, a public and a private kind of levels, or, A sensitive and non-sensitive, the words I'm looking for.
Okay.
Talked about shutting off port 43 to the public, depending on, you know, what information is sensitive and non-sensitive, and who, and then it asks who is the public, who gets access, and then it comes up with a few recommendations about answering that our own question there.
Okay.
It talks about playing the who is information on a public website, and we make the statement that based on our experience, we know that the type systems aren't theoretically, you know, are theoretically crackable, but based on our experience, those types of systems plus other kind of things do help limit mining. We also want to continue to be able to provide identity protection services. That's kind of in quotes. So, you know.
Hold on, Paul. I'm sorry. The echo is getting really unbearable. Glenn, how do you mute your phone?
Press 6.
Just press 6? All right, I'm going to try muting mine and see if it makes a difference.
I'll remute mine, all right?
You are now muted.
Test, test, test. That seems much better. I'm going to continue talking. Hopefully people can hear me. Anyway, it's the registrars wanted to want to continue to be able to provide those kind of services to the registrants. Two other things I think it also talks about is we think that the WHOIS data should remain as close as possible to the registrants, the actual storage of it, because as soon as that gets away from the registrants, it's less and less and less in their control. And then the final thing is a point about that there's different types of getting the ways of getting the WHOIS information. You know, you could mine the port 43 output of a registrar. You could mine the FAT registry's port 43 output. You could do, you know, screen scraping or basically mining of web-based output of the registrars, the registries, and you could get it, you know, via bulk access. And the statement is basically that it's all for one and one for all kind of thing. If something applies to one of those, it should apply to all of them. You know, if there's a safeguard or policy that controls one, it should apply to the other ones. They're all kind of the same thing in our minds. That's it.
Okay, I think do you hear an echo with me?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Wow. Okay. I was just going to say, I think it was my phone. I think that last part, the last thing you said, that any solution policy should apply to all forms of WHOIS. I think that's an important one to...
There's an example in there. For example, if, let's say we decide that the identity of the requester and the purpose, for example, have to be known, you know, is available to the registrant in certain circumstances for bulk access, then it should also be known for, you know, high query rate mining of port 43. That's the example to put in the document.
Yeah, I think that's an important one, and I think that's one, when you look at the 7 points or so that we've talked about, I think that's not one, you know, it's always been talked about, but I don't think we put that in there, so I think we're going to need to add another one in there on that point, unless anybody disagrees. Does anybody think there should be different rules for different ways, different policies depending on which form of access is provided? Hearing no objection. It could be because everyone's on mute. But I'll put
because not everyone's on the call.
That too. But I'm gonna put this in the document, and it's up to people that aren't on the call to kind of read the document and to make sure that they agree or disagree. You know, to tell us if they disagree with any of these statements.
The idea being that it doesn't matter how you get it, whether it's bulk, web, or...
Morning, Tony Harris, Johnny.
Hi, good morning, Tony.
Or port 43 or some other method, it's all the same. doesn't matter how you get it. It's the same. You know, if we show all the information, for example, if that's what we decide via, you know, kind of like what we have now via port 43, there's no difference between, you know, repeatedly requesting port 43 information and getting bulk information.
I think that makes sense, Tony. We were just going over the registrar statement, which hasn't quite yet been finalized, although it's getting pretty close. And Paul's going to send it around to the group. But one of his points that I think we should make sure we add in our preliminary report is that, and I just wrote these notes to myself, we'll phrase it differently, but basically any access to all forms of WHOIS should have the same policy rules apply. In other words, you know, if you have a policy with respect to, you know, that a requester needs to identify themselves, let's say that's the policy, then that needs to be the case whether you're accessing it through port 43 or you're accessing it in bulk, you're accessing it on the web. It's the same rules should apply regardless of the means of access.
That sounds reasonable.
Okay. Paul, if I can ask you a clarifying question.
Yeah.
When you say registrars want to preserve, and I'm not using the words you used, but basically say registrars want to continue providing their value-add services to registrants, can you go into that a little bit more and, like, what you meant by that or what the registrars mean by that and what kinds of services you're talking about?
It's basically this statement says, if Task Force 2 determines that sensitive information must be displayed on the web, the registrars support a policy whereby registrars may, and then one of them is, continue to provide identity protection products to registrants. And what they, I think, mean by identity protection is products like domains by proxy GoDaddy offers and ID Protect that Enum offers, and, you know, NSI has one. A number of registrars have these kind of identity protection services. I think we don't want to be precluded from offering those kind of things.
Okay. And
whose identity are you protecting? The registrant?
Correct.
If you're protecting his identity and law enforcement wants to know who he is, what do you do?
In Enum's case, we give that up to law enforcement. We basically remove the cloak.
Okay, fine.
Now, do you
I'm not talking to all, I'm not speaking for all registrars on that.
Now, with the registrars, and this maybe wasn't discussed, but
I should go a little bit further on that because I think we also remove it for intellectual property attorneys.
Okay, so if you got notification that, you know, an organization was working on behalf of a company on IP issues, that would give you the confidence to help them further with their inquiry.
Correct.
That kind of thing.
In Enum's case, that's true, and also I believe we work with anti-spam groups, and we release it to them as well.
Okay.
Now, do you get consent from the registrants to do all that stuff?
Before they sign up. Or, you know, as they're signing up, we say, this is when we could release your information.
Now, would the registrars, because obviously, if each registrar had, there's the potential, if we come out with some policies and we say, you know, sensitive information must be disclosed, but the requester needs to identify themselves. You know, we have all these. We've discussed this in the past. It may conflict because now what you're saying is the registrars believe that even if the policy is that this information should be disclosed, subject to the requester disclosing who they are, and subject to the registrant finding out who's requesting their information, this kind of goes against that. Do you see where there's a conflict?
Yes, but on the other hand, the statement says, if blah, 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 we may.
Well, I guess the point is that, let's say task, because we were saying, if task, what we've been talking about these last few weeks, is if Task Force 2 determines that sensitive information must be displayed, then we would recommend, the policy would be that the requester identifies him or herself, that the registrant is made aware of who the requester is and the purpose for which the information is being solicited. Now, what you're saying is that the registrars above and beyond that would still refuse to disclose the information because they are offering their value-add services.
I believe that's correct.
So that there is a conflict there.
But we had the proviso in anyway. If it was a police-style query or some other kind of IP, that then they wouldn't go to the... They wouldn't inform them of the query, though.
Well, but the point...
That's a separate thing, but that's correct, too.
But the point we had was that this was going to be available to all, and one of Wendy's points that was really important is that if any party's got the right... If law enforcement and an IP attorney has got the right to the information, then anyone should have the right to the information, subject to the fact if they subject to the requirement that they disclose who they are and the purpose for which they are soliciting the information.
I don't think that's a valid argument, really. I mean, I wouldn't put a spammer on the same footing as an IP attorney or law enforcement.
Could I comment on that, please? I think the point is basically, without any process, any judicial process in place, law enforcement or an IP attorney are really just anybody. If they get a subpoena, of course, they have a special position. If they have a court order, they have a special position. But in that case, you have due process in place. If they can come along, ask for the information, and get it without any further traces, then anybody else should get it too. That's the point which is being made here. If law enforcement with a court order comes and asks for information, that's of course an entirely different case. What we are talking about here is access without special process. That's a distinction which should be made, Tony.
Okay.
Right. So what we have in there is, this is the exact statement. It was number four, and I think Barbara had resent it around after the last meeting. Number four said, to the extent that sensitive data is required to be publicly disclosed by WHOIS Task Force 2, then at a minimum, the requester of the WHOIS information should be required to identify themselves to the WHOIS provider, i.e. the registrar or the registry in the case of thick registries, along with the reasons for which it seeks the data. Such information should be made available to the registrant whose WHOIS information is sought. The group recognizes, however, that an exception may need to be granted for certain legitimate users, so for certain law enforcement officials who may need information, legitimate, actually it says legitimate users are, or law enforcement officials who may need the information without having to provide the reasons to the registrant. This point needs to be explored more. In the past, I think the IP constituency has said, this process should not delay the timely delivery of WHOIS information. In addition, all IP attorneys should fall within this exception. The ALAC, Wendy has said, similar to what Thomas is saying, that, you know, there shouldn't be any, you know, if IP owners and IP attorneys are given this, then there shouldn't, you know, then really everyone falls within this exception. And then, of course, who is law enforcement and how, what is the process for this to be done? You know, and again, in this preliminary report, we can come out with a recommendation and unanswered questions. That's fine. But what Paul is saying and what the registrars are now saying is, well, even if you have this policy, we still don't want to provide the information. We still want to offer these value-add services for which, the registrars are getting compensated for, that would provide even more privacy protection. And also, Paul, and correct me if I'm wrong, while you guys, Enom, offers one type of service, I'm not sure if GoDaddy or Network Solutions discloses the same information upon the same burden of proof, right?
So we have separate rules. So I agree with that.
Right.
I want to say quickly that the reason isn't for bad guys to hide from good guys. That's not what, in my opinion, I don't think the demand's coming from that. I think a lot of the demands coming from people who believe, rightly or wrongly, that their information is being taken and either used for spamming or for other purposes. That's a big part of it. And then another part of the demand is coming from for example, two companies want to do a merger, and they have a new domain name, ExxonMobil.com, let's say, and they don't want people to know it's them that are doing a merger, or they're coming out with a movie, and they don't want people to know that the name of the movie that they're coming out with, that kind of thing. So we want to be able to continue to offer that to customers.
Okay.
One question here. Current policy requires publication of full information, and it doesn't keep you from offering these services.
That's correct.
So, in a way, I don't see how this group could even make policy that would be able to prevent these services from happening.
That's good, then.
It's just really a question of logic. We are dealing with a contractual relationship, and we have no rule whatsoever that the registrant has to be something like, say, the immediate economical beneficiary of the domain name, like what you have in money laundering terms with bank accounts. So as long as that rule isn't there, I think it will be relatively hard to come up with a policy that would keep you from providing these services. It's just the registrant, after all.
That's good. So I think it's just a just-in-case thing.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, but
don't know the extent of our policy-making abilities, maybe, and so I think it doesn't hurt to put it in.
The question is, though, should there be some sort of best practices for those types of services? Or is that something that the market should define? Because, you know, while you, Enom, disclose information to any IP attorney that may request it, I don't think GoDaddy is as lenient. Now, that could be a selling point for GoDaddy. That could be a selling point for you all.
I'm not sure if it's any. I don't know our policy exactly. I don't know if it's any IP attorney. I don't know how we tell if that they're IP attorneys. Maybe it's just experience with attorneys who call us.
Right.
I don't know our exact policy on that, but I see what your point is. Should there be a standardized thing? Why not just let the market figure that out?
How do Jeremy? Are you still on?
Yeah. So I lost that last bit of this. I got a bit of flaky now. Can you just give me that last couple, literally last 20 seconds? I was on a real static bit then, I'm afraid.
Okay. I think the point is that we had come out with a one of the registrar's points is that. To the extent that Who Is Task Force 2 requires that what we labeled as sensitive data to be disclosed, as long as if they require that to be publicly disclosed, we had said in the past that the only requirements would be for the requester to identify him or herself and the purpose for which he or she seeks the information, and that information would be disclosed to the registrant. Now, what
right.
Paul's saying is that the registrars want to add an additional element on that, is that the registrars should also be free to offer their domains by proxy or their privacy services so that even if, you know, the requester identifies himself and the purpose, what the requester may get back is this name is under the Enom privacy service, and for more information they have to go to Enom and follow their processes, basically is what that's saying.
Okay. Well, supposing an ISP needs to look up details on a domain name because he has a denial of service attack to investigate or something like that, he's not a law enforcement. An ISP is not a law enforcement agency, right?
Yeah.
So our concern as ISPs would be. Since we're in the actual operations of the internet, and these things tend to have an urgent nature, how is this access by ISPs to the information going to be adjusted within these considerations?
Paul, any thoughts on that?
Thomas here, one thought, what if the information given in an entirely transparent, entirely open system turns out to be useless? What if the technical contact is entirely incompetent and speaks an obscure Chinese dialect? Or maybe is just incompetent? I don't think it's structurally different from what you're probably increasingly experiencing these days, when end users can register domain names and can actually enter themselves as technical contacts.
Well, I think
they may be entirely unable to deal with a DDoS situation, even if their computer is involved.
Well, one of the things to keep in mind, Thomas, is that, and I'm not sure we actually came to a. I think we said that that technical contact name and their information would be viewed as non-sensitive data. So that would be displayed. But again, I don't know, Paul, if you guys...
My answer to that would be you should... It's not really on the domain name side of the WHOIS. It's more on the IP address side of the WHOIS. I don't believe that if, you know, we get denial of service attacks. We have one going on now. They're going on 24 hours a day. We don't use the domain name WHOIS information to figure out what's going on or to help us. We use the IP address WHOIS information to figure that out. And even when we do look up an IP address using the WHOIS for an IP address, it still doesn't help us because most times the IP addresses are spoofed. So it's like two levels of removal from domain name WHOIS information. That'd be my comment.
Yeah, that's valid. But nonetheless, we would like... to see this access situation resolved in some logical way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the proviso you mentioned earlier was that, you know, regarding law enforcement / others, I think that could kind of be a bigger... I think that's going to be picked up by quite a few people. So, but if it's in there, then at least we flagged it, and you know our concerns have been kind of echoed in that, if you like, and then we can deal with it from there.
Okay. So we're going to have to. I'll try to incorporate that into the statement and see how it flows. And we'll have to just look at it and see what questions arise.
I kind of got to say I agree with Thomas on that question. I'm more on his side of the spectrum. You know, I don't see how we could legislate the technical contact being competent or, you know, speaking your language or whatever. I just don't see it that much of a benefit.
Well, no, we can't. But what we can do and what Task Force 3 is doing is requiring that information is accurate. I don't know how they're going to come out. Maybe, Thomas, you have more insight on that. But, you know,
I'm not on three. I'm on two.
Oh, sorry about that. So I think in the end, you know, that's not really our concern, although, you know, when the council deals with this, they're going to have to deal with all three reports. But, you know, assuming it's accurate information, you know, if it's in another language, well, that's the ISPs. You know, they're going to have to deal with that. Different languages.
Yeah, but if it's accurate and you know, Enum puts some technical contact on every technical contact, what's that going to do?
So they're going to put what on there?
Let's say Enum is a technical contact for all these names.
Right.
But A, why wouldn't we? Because what's the liability there? And B, so people send an email that goes nowhere. I don't see that's a benefit to the Internet. That's my...
Here's the kind of issue that there's been with these privacy services is that the way I would view it and the way a lot of attorneys view it, and this is separate as being a registry, but just kind of as an attorney, my argument as an attorney would be that the registrar steps into the shoes of the registrant, and to the extent that it refuses to disclose who the technical contact is or any contact is, then it is accepting a liability on behalf of the registrant. Now, even if it's got a contract with the registrant that says that they don't accept it, as between the attorney complaining, it does accept the liability. And it could later pass it on if it wants to the registrant. But at least initially, it's got that liability. Now, that's never really been tested in a court, but that's the way I believe it would come out.
What's the liability for being a technical contact? I see the liability for being the registrant or maybe the admin contact. Being the technical contact, what's the liability?
Yeah, no, I was talking in the overall. So I don't know if you differentiate between registrant, technical contact, and admin contact. But I'm saying to the extent that a registrar refuses to give out any contact information.
If the registrant says, put this information as the technical contact, who are we to say no?
Well, you are, to the extent that all right, forget the technical contact aspect, but let's, as the whole registration.
Okay.
If a registrant were to say, I want you to put this as the admin, I want to put you as the admin, technical billing, and registrant. I want you for all of it. Then you are kind of signing up, even though the registrant is telling you to do that.
Whoever that is signing up. I see that.
Right.
But so, if that ENOM, ENOM has no liability then.
Right. If it's not ENOM selling the privacy service and putting their own information in, but it's just a registrant putting whatever information they want in.
Forget about who's selling it. It doesn't, even if ENOM does, quote, sell this, but the information is not ENOM, where's ENOM's liability?
What do you mean it's not ENOM?
To the extent that
ENOM or GoDaddy or anyone dictates who the technical billing and admin contact is, even if in a contract between the registrar and the registrant they disclaim the liability, as between all other parties, they can't really disclaim that liability.
It's kind of like registered agent services for companies. You're saying that the registered agent for McDonald's has a liability that for owning McDonald's or for what McDonald's does?
If the registered agent refuses to disclose who is the right contact and refuses to pass that on, that is what the registered agent is signing up
for. I see that. They only pass it on. They don't disclose, do they?
Well, but when someone contacts a registered agent, they know who the person is that they're serving. Like, I know, let's say I'm suing McDonald's, to use your example. I already know who McDonald's is. I already know who I'm suing. I serve the registered agent because I don't know where their primary location is. I don't know where they accept service. So I can look up in a directory. I go to McDonald's. Okay, they're a Delaware corporation. Okay, so I go to look up their registered agent and their corporation. It says their registered agent is so-and-so, so I serve them. This is a little bit different, right? I don't know who the registrant is, and therefore I'm coming to you, the registrar, to say, who the heck is it so I can serve them? And if you, the registrar, say, don't worry about who it is, I'll accept service on their behalf, which is what a registered agent does, that's one thing. But I don't think any registrar has kind of signed up for that yet.
I'm following it.
So, anyway, that's kind of a little bit off.
Thank you for diverting.
Sorry about that. So what I'll try to do then is work into the statement the registrars, and then we'll get comments from the other constituencies as far as how they feel about whether that actually circumvents the entire statement or whether that's consistent. And Thomas and Paul have argued that it's consistent. We'll just hear from everybody else as well. The other thing you talked about, Paul, and this is when there was a lot of echo, so I might ask you to repeat it. You had said something about shutting off port 43, and
yeah.
I kind of missed it because there was so much echo.
It says, I use shutting off because I know it's controversial. So I wanted to go to the extreme on this. It could say changing port 43 to something else or drastically modifying it or whatever.
To alleviate what concerns?
What's that?
To alleviate what concerns? I mean, I'm just trying to get that. Is that in the statement as to why, not just the point you should shut it off, but does it go into why?
It's saying if we decide to shut it off or drastically modify it.
Oh, if, okay. Then
Well, it says, if Task Force 2 determines that sensitive information must be displayed, blah, 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 the registrar support a policy whereby registrars may shut off port 43 access to the public.
Okay, now would that be at the discretion, are you saying at the discretion of the registrar?
It doesn't say. It just says...
Well, I guess by saying registrars may shut off, it's pretty much they may or they may not, right? So that would to imply...
That's true.
Okay.
And then it goes further and it says, well, who's the public? That's the question. And then who has access? In other words, who's not the public?
Now, let me ask another kind of related question. Do registrars think they still need port 43 to, let's say, for transfers?
That's the very first part.
Okay.
Registrars must be granted access to port 43 who is in standardized format, but only for the purposes of performing transfers and only for so long as all GTLD registries are not EPP, thick or thin, or until another inter-registrar transfer mechanism replaces it.
Okay.
And then the second one is, the identities of the non-public requesters must be known to the registrars and may be recorded by the registrar so that it can be communicated to the registrants in appropriate circumstances. And then three is, the requester must have a defined valid purpose, each request, and that purpose must be known to the registrars and may be recorded by the registrar so that it can be communicated to the registrants. Some registrars believe a valid purpose exists currently and some do not. And then the last one is, the requester cannot act as a proxy. And then there's, you know, three sections. The last part of the third section is, port 43 query rate limiting must be allowed to protect against mining, but the level of limit must be determined.
So that if port 43 is open to certain requesters, because it seems like if it's not open, then...
That's correct. Even if we have non-sensitive information being displayed or outputted in port 43, we still need query limiting. But that it could be a high level. That's my interpretation of this.
Okay.
Yeah, the ISPs propose the same thing.
Right. And actually, we should probably move on. Any other questions for Paul on the registrar statement?
So just let me clarify. So in addition to if there's any field limiting, you're also going to do query limiting as well.
That's correct. If there is field limiting, in other words, let's say we just show the name of the registrant, there should also be a query limit, but it should be, we're saying that that limit must be determined, but I would assume that it would be a high limit.
So the query limit's really proportional to the data that's...
I just don't want our systems to be overloaded with people pounding the crap out of it, and we have to comply just because it's in this contract.
Higher limit for non-sensitive data. In other words, that goes back to the whole point that information is more valuable, or the more you have information, the sensitive data, the more valuable it is.
It goes back to the question of, it costs zero to query, so anything is worth something above zero.
But then it also goes back to the fact that if you're going to do data limiting anyway, then just use data limiting to, as we were initially talking about a few weeks ago, to do the actual limiting of to try and prevent data mining.
The problem with that is you don't know who to, what the limit would have to be really low then in that case.
But I seem to remember from an initial one of our meetings, you know, one of our early meetings, that I think the initial impression was that it's a case of most of the stuff is down fairly low, but the mining ones are a real big spike. So it was an option that the limits could be fairly low.
Generally, that's not the case because the miners have access to a large number of... The only way to do it via port 43 is to monitor which queries come from what IPs. And the miners have access to a large number of IPs. So it's really difficult without having a whitelist to do that. So there, if you go down that path, that you have to bring in, unfortunately, the knot is tangled, and you have to bring in other things to help untie it.
Basically, if you want to have effective rate limiting, you have to do the rate limiting based on, well, on who the requester is. That means you have to identify the requester some way in the first place. And what's possible here is just saying the information that you get from the network itself is not sufficient. So you have to build an identification mechanism to do effective rate limiting, in fact.
So what are the thoughts of doing it this way?
Identify themselves. Use certificates, for instance. Reliably identify the requester. Then you can do rate limits on a per requested basis.
And will these certificates, is it envisioned that these certificates would be the same certificate to identify people to the white list to allow them to access sensitive/non-sensitive information?
That could be the case.
I agree with Thomas on that. The problem is port 43, the way it's specified, doesn't have provisions for any of that. That's why it would have to be drastically modified or moved to a different port or something. And so if we moved it to a different port, we were thinking that port 43 could still exist but show the non-sensitive stuff, in which case there would need to be some limit just so that the registrars or the registry systems don't get overloaded with people doing free queries for nearly, you know, not so valuable information but still value above zero. That's why there would be some limit on that.
Then you would be looking at doing a double, you're in effect then looking at doing a double, in effect a double whitelist.
You lost me on that one.
Well, in effect, that there's one whitelist to say whether you are you can access sensitive/non-sensitive, and then there's another one dependent on the registrar to see whether you're a high volume or low volume.
No.
Is that correct?
I don't think so. I was thinking that the non-sensitive information would be outputted via the current port 43 who is. That way, all the clients still work and so on. We're just saying that would have a high query rate no matter who it is.
Okay, so there'd be no restriction on that at all.
Not based on who it is, but it would have a high query limit. Maybe even in aggregate.
Basically, what it boils down to is you have one kind of rate limiting to prevent people from collecting a large amount of data. And what Paul is talking about is a different kind of rate limiting that's supposed to keep people from doing a DOS attack against the servers.
Exactly.
There's two different levels, and you can still accumulate a whole lot of data that would not be acceptable from a policy point of view if it was sensitive data within the margins of not overloading the system.
We're saying that if that limit, then it would block somebody else from getting in.
All right, Paul, so you're gonna submit your statement around to the group so we all can look at it, kind of think about it some more?
Yeah, I want to call the chair of the registrar constituency just to see the rules on that, but I suspect they'll send it today.
All right, I want to spend a little time, because now that Tony's on, if Tony can go over the ISP statement, and then I'll take a little bit of time to go over the registry statement. Tony, still with us?
Yeah.
Good.
What do you want me to do, the recommendations? What we propose?
Right, exactly.
Okay, in light of small and regional ISPs' reliance on port 43 access, the ISPCP constituency believes use ought to be preserved at this time. However, its use should be strictly limited by non-technical means such as rate limiting. In the long term, we strongly discourage its continued use. A general agreement would be useful on the types of uses that are legitimate and should be continued. Any proposed solution should include such legitimate access, including web-based queries, and be scalable. ICANN staff should undertake development of a uniform access policy that is enforced. In addition, compliance procedures for such a policy should be implemented. And finally, the ISPCP rejects the notion that the purpose of WHOIS data is not intended for tracking registrants that are in the business of violating laws or deceiving end users, and thus should not be used for any purpose beyond technical reasons. That's it.
On that last point, I'm sorry, I didn't understand that last one. That basically that, correct me if I don't mean to misword it, but I'm trying to understand. So what you're saying is that there's people that argue that the WHOIS was only used initially for technical reasons, but
the non-coms say that specifically in their position or in their response to this. And the ICP is saying we don't agree with that.
Right, that even if that was the initial, then it's still evolved.
Yeah.
And okay.
It is used for tracking registrants. It should be used for tracking registrants that are in the business of violations and fraud.
Okay.
I know it's worded. The ending of the phrase confuses a bit.
All right, any questions for Tony? Okay, now I'll spend a couple minutes on the registry position, although it really should be David, because I'm just going to read to you what parts of the statements and why it was that case. The registry took a unique approach to this, and what we did in order to come up with a statement was kind of divided this initially into a bunch of different questions and then kind of answered those questions. And again, it's the registry state, the same thing that I think everybody else has kind of agreed with, is that, you know, much of what we do as Task Force 1 really relies heavily on what Task Force 2 does. If Task Force 2 makes a recommendation that only non-sensitive data is to be displayed, then obviously the privacy and data mining become much less significant issues. So that's the basic overall premise, and I think everyone kind of has been echoing that as well. The basic recommendations of the constituency, you know, what it says is, look, any changes to WHOIS, we really need to look at the operational impact. So while from a policy standpoint they may sound like great policy, eventually there really needs to be an operational study on the impact of these policy recommendations on, you know, how we would implement it needs to be looked at. And then also not only operational but also a financial impact. What would be the impact, recognizing that a domain name from a registry standpoint is only a $5 to $6 product and, you know, even less a margin for some of the registrars. One of the other, so the questions that the registries looked at are, you know, what types of access should be made available for viewing WHOIS information, and the basic point from the registries are that, you know, the web-based WHOIS access should be at the discretion of any registry or registrar, but also that we should pay attention to the specifications that are being developed now within the CRISP working group, which is a part of the IETF that's coming out with this new protocol called IRIS, so that you should look to that to see if that provides any guidance of how to technically implement this. Actually, what I'm going to look for now is, because Glenn put all these statements together, and I'm looking off that version, it's kind of bundled together, so I'm just going to look at the one that we did. Sorry, I'm just switching here to a different version. Okay, the next question that was asked, and what we also did is we did the percentage of registries that agreed with the point. We said any implementation of WHOIS access should permit registries to customize WHOIS access to applicable law. So, in other words, if, you know, even if there's a policy we come out with, if that's not in accordance with applicable law, then you got to allow the registries or registrars to customize the service to comply with law. The next thing is that port 43 access should only be required if it can be implemented to accommodate privacy legislation in the country where the registry operates. Bulk access should not be allowed for marketing purposes. WHOIS bulk access should not be required as it is under who is bulk access should not be required as it is currently required under the current registry agreements. The registries recognize that certain parties, i.e. law enforcement, IP, may at times need to have better access to who is. We suggest that a technical solution be identified which allows legitimate parties to search for the information they need without requiring registries to turn over all data that they have in the who is, like the bulk access currently requires, and then to look at maybe the IRIS protocol as providing a potential technical solution. As restrictions are and likely to remain standardized, it would be good to consider standardizing the request format, too. With regard to access for registrars, an ICANN-administered registry of authorized IP numbers may be useful. That goes to kind of the whitelist concept. Non-registry and non-registrar access should be on a need-to-know basis and limited to users that can demonstrate a legitimate need for the information. For example, law enforcement agencies with an appropriate legal basis for a request, i.e. subpoena, should have access to the personal information when necessary for law enforcement purposes. Intellectual property researchers should have access subject to agreements limiting the use. The second question the registry sought to answer was, what has been the effect on registry systems of having to make available who is information via port 43? And that kind of varied between registries. On the thin registries, there's been little effect because there hasn't been that kind of mining on port 43 because they don't have all of the what we would call sensitive information. But on the larger, thick registries, we all have certainly experienced problems, operational problems from very high rates of requests on port 43. So that was kind of the how we all stood on that, that there was a difference between thin, and also actually there was a difference between smaller registries like the .coops, .museums of the world that really didn't have significant negative impact of port 43 mining. Third question we kind of sought to answer was, have we noticed a problem with data mining? And the registries, 89% of the registries said that data mining tends to be more significant with larger, thick registries, and we do have data available to support the problems that we've had. Some registries, New Level actually being one of them, have received spam complaints from registrants. Question four that we sought to answer was,
Can you read that one? The spam complaints from registrants?
Yeah, that we've had complaints of people, and I even got one today. You know, we get complaints that people are mining our who is for spam purposes.
Oh, I follow it. Okay.
The next question is, well, has anyone actually instituted anything to prevent any data mining, like put in speed bumps for port 43 or a cloudy GIF for web-based access, and what has been the effect? The registries have instituted the following types of mechanisms to deal with data mining: limitations on port 43 access, timeouts which temporarily block high-rate users, reduced returns on wildcard queries, system tuning, blocking IP numbers of large volume abusive requests, and rate controls. Publication of the delete pending list for registrars as required for RGP has resulted in reduced mining for some registries. In other words, thick registries have found that because RGP, the redemption grace period, requires registry to publish a list of which names are up for which are in the delete pending period, that before we were required to do this, we actually got a lot of mining, you know, from registrars and registrants wanting to know when things deleted. Now that we publish these lists, that's not as much of a problem.
Can I add one point here? Sorry to digress on WLS, but if WLS sure. is implemented, expirations are published in the registry's who is output, I believe that the registry that will greatly increase mining of registry's who is.
Can you actually put that in, just send that in an email to the list?
Sure.
I think I
say the reason in there too. It's kind of lengthy.
Okay, no, that's good. And then we had registries must be allowed to implement anti-data mining controls because restrictions have unpleasant side effects for innocent parties, including registries and registrars. Standardization of anti-data mining practices should be considered to minimize undesirable side effects. Question five that we sought to answer was, is it feasible to have tiered access to WHOIS information, i.e. only allow some groups to be able to use port 43 while allowing others to use web-based access? If so, how would that be implemented? What are the pros and cons, and what issues would still need to be worked out? Well, the registry said, well, yes, it's feasible to have tiered access to WHOIS. The registries note that, you know, a possible way to do that is through the IRIS protocol. But again, we have to study the operational impact of what that would allow to do to the registries and registrars that have to implement it. The second point is ICANN should administer an access rights database to WHOIS information with appropriate separate treatment for different top-level domains where necessary. To clarify that, we said the issue of data privacy will inevitably lead to restricting WHOIS access and eventually create a situation where certain parties will have better access to than others to WHOIS data. Providing a centralized administration of access rights will reduce a burden on each individual registry and move the responsibility for granting access rights to the party which prescribed it. So in other words, registries didn't want it left to their own discretion as to who is a legitimate party, and that there needs to be some central database that would let registries and registrars know which parties are, quote, legitimate. Registries were worried that, you know, one registry may determine one party to be legitimate, another registry may not, and there would be some liability associated with that. WHOIS policy decisions should be based on technologies that may become available in the future, for example, IRIS, not just the technologies that exist today, the, i.e. the Port 43 and cloudy GIF images. So, again, there's a high reliance in the registry constituency on the work that is being done in CRISP, with the CRISP working group, the IRIS protocol. And one thing that we want to clarify is, though, the work that's being done within CRISP is all technical, and it doesn't make the policy decisions. What it does is it provides a mechanism to implement policy decisions that are being made. So, example, if the policy is that there should be tiered access or only certain elements should be displayed to certain parties, well, the IRIS protocol can technically implement that, but the policy decision still needs to be made by the GNSO, by ICANN. And so that's a key point to keep in mind. So, you know, even though there is this CRISP working group developing the IRIS protocol, that doesn't solve or even address the policy issues. So again, I think the concluding statements are, it's essential to deal with the issue of personal privacy, to balance the issues of personal privacy with intellectual property and law enforcement's need for the information. We recognize that certain parties may at times need to have access to a number of the WHOIS elements. A technical means for this tiered access could be through IRIS protocol developed through the CRISP working group. When finalized, we believe a comprehensive review of this technical solution should be undertaken. We believe a more detailed effort is needed to identify any specific parties that need access to selected elements and what information should be obtained through such access. A cost-benefit analysis should be done when considering significant changes. Careful consideration should be given to the feasibility of registrars and registries implementing any of these proposed changes. And also looking into enforcement of such requirements. And that sufficient time should be given to allow migration to this new system. And so that's the basic registry statement, kind of detailed, which is why it kind of took us a long time to come out with.
I have a question.
Sure.
I don't want to monopolize the time. I know I've been talking a lot on this call. But why do the registries want the WHOIS? It seems like it'd be a lot easier if you just didn't have it.
What do you mean, why do thick registries want to display WHOIS at all?
Yeah. Why do they even want to be involved in it at all? That's my question.
I guess if you were to give the registries a choice, they probably would say that they wouldn't. But I think the registries realize that it is probably unlikely that ICANN would not require registries to display the information because it is a centralized source. So that law enforcement and other legitimate users didn't have to go to the 100 or so different registrars to get the information, that it could go to one source.
I hear what you're saying, but if that's the only reason, CRISP solves that. because it can distribute queries to whoever's got the information, even across PLDs.
Right, CRISP may solve that.
That's right, so then there still goes back to my question. Let's say that was solved. Why would you want the information then? And do you think that...
To be honest, I don't think that's a question the registries entertained, because I don't think any of the registries realized that that would ever become a reality. So I think maybe if I went back and posted that question, and I'll do that, I'll post that question and see what they think. But I guess the view in some of our discussions was we didn't think that that would be a reality, so we kind of didn't.
It's just the further that it gets away from the registrants, the more problems it creates. For example, you know, if we do a registry, or I mean a registrar does something like ID Protect or whatever, domains by proxy, you're going to get, the registry will get that information. They won't have the information behind that information. So it just, that's like one example of a problem. It just seems like the more it gets away from the guy who owns the information, which is the registrant, the more problems that it creates, the more sources of leaks. And, you know, besides the centralized location so that we could do easier queries issue, I don't see any benefit. That's just me. I'd be curious to see what they say in the answer to your question.
Yeah, I will post that to the registries and see what they say. Any other questions? Okay, so now we have these constituency statements. We have our kind of policies that we talked about. We need to synthesize all this into a preliminary report. And I think what we need to do, and we'll probably need to have more than one call next week and the week after, because I think our report is due, and Glenn, if you're still on, correct me if I'm wrong.
Muting, canceled.
Due May.
That's right, 6th of May, Jeff.
Which is actually 2 weeks from Thursday.
Yeah.
So I need to know from you all whether we can do, you know, a couple calls next week to kind of synthesize this stuff. And I need to talk to Barbara. So I'm going to probably be using the email list a lot over the next couple of days to try to coordinate all of this stuff and maybe get some help on drafting this preliminary report. So please, when you see this, respond and let me know if you can help.
Okay.
In the meantime, I was hoping Barbara was on the call. But in the meantime, Glenn is going to send to us a copy of what's required in the bylaws for this preliminary statement. And then I will talk to Barbara as to how we can, what the best way of going about this would be.
Sounds fine.
All right. I appreciate everyone's time. And next week we'll probably use the full hour and a half for the call and then probably try to schedule one on. Glenn, can you schedule another one on Thursday at the same time?
Thursday of next week, fine, Jeff. I'll not be on the calls next week. But
okay.
I've made provision for MP3s to be done because that helps Barbara.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Okay.
And the Thursday call, do you want it at the same time?
Well, let me ask, does Thursday work for everyone?
It works for me.
Okay.
Good. Okay, I'll schedule then the two, and you'll get the notification today, Scott.
Great. All right, thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
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 Bye.